fighting for us. He was performing acts mocking the Reich, the mayor states flatly. His voice is cold. The Germans want to try him for treason. I picture Astrid, hear her cries as they had taken Peter. At least let us see him then, I venture. The mayor raises his eyebrows, surprised I have spoken.
That's quite impossible.
He's going to be a father, I want to say, appealing to the mayor as one who has a son. But I have sworn to keep her secret, and I doubt it would sway the mayor. Our circus owner died tonight, and we need Peter so much more now. Please, I beg, searching for the right words and not finding them.
It's out of my hands, the mayor replies. He's been taken to the old army camp on the outskirts of town to be deported, sent east, first thing in the morning.
A distressed look crosses Luke's face. I thought they weren't using the camp anymore.
They aren't,
his father replies, a note of grimness to his voice.
Only for special cases.
Papa, do something, Luke says,
trying again, still wanting to believe. I see now the boy who had defended his father, even after the awful things he had done.
I can't,
the mayor says flatly.
You won't even help your son?
Luke demands. There is a new forcefulness to his voice.
I suppose it isn't surprising since you sold out your own people. How dare you?
He thunders.
I'm your father. My father helped people. My father would never have stood by while our friends and neighbors were arrested. And he would have done something to help now. You are not my father,
Luke spits. And I wonder if he has gone too far.
If Mama were here, enough!
The mayor barks, voice cutting through the still night air.
You have no idea the things I faced, or the choices I've had to make to protect you. If your mother was here, it is you she'd be ashamed of. You were never like this before.
His eyes shoot daggers in my direction.
It must be her doing. Circus trash with no upbringing.
Luke steps forward, putting himself between his father and me.
Don't say such things about Noah. Never mind,
the mayor replies, dismissing me with a wave of his hand.
They'll be gone soon enough. You should come inside now, Luke.
No, Luke says, meeting his father's eyes.
I can't stay here. Not anymore.
He turns to me.
Let's go. Luke! Wait!
The mayor calls, his voice rising with surprise.
Goodbye, Papa.
Luke takes my hand and leads me away from the villa, leaving the mayor alone in the doorway. Are you sure you want to do this? I ask, as we pass through the gate. Luke keeps walking, eyes forward. His strides are so long, I almost have to skip to keep up. We reach the edge of the forest.
Wait,
I say, stopping.
Are you sure? If you need to go back, I understand. He's your father, after all.
I'm not going back,
he replies. You mean, ever? I ask. He nods.
But where will you go?
I ask, my concern for him rising. Luke does not answer, but instead takes me in his arms and presses his lips against mine hard, as though trying to wipe away what had just happened. I return his kisses, willing us back to earlier that night before everything had changed. Then he breaks away.
I'm sorry, Noah,
he says.
For a moment, I think he is talking about the kiss. About Peter? I ask. Don't be. You tried. Not just for that. For all of it. He kisses me once more. Goodbye, Noah. Then he starts away in the other direction through the trees, leaving me behind. Chapter 20. Noah. The funeral takes place the next day on a too sunny morning in the local cemetery. A nest of leaning headstones along the same hilly road on the far side of Tears we'd climbed the day of the arrival parade. Herr Newhoff's is a lone grave behind the rest, overhung by a willow tree. Looking down at the closed oak casket, I imagine how he must look inside, lifeless body gray and waxy in his magnificent ringmaster suit. He does not belong here. He should be back in Germany, resting beside his wife. Instead, he will lie here forever. Sadness engulfs me. He had been everything to us, protected us, and now he is gone. In the end, it was Herr Newhoff's health that had killed him. His heart condition had been worsening right before us, although he'd done his best to hide it so we would not worry. The stress of keeping the circus going could not have helped. We had all been too caught up in our own concerns to notice. Then the struggle with the police had simply been the final straw. Or so we thought. We would never really know. We stand uncertainly around the coffin. Someone should say something about the benefactor who meant so much to us. But we have no minister. Peter is gone, and Astrid is in no shape. At the front, close to the gravesite, Emmett stands alone, tears streaming down his fat cheeks. The rest of the circus folk keep their distance, and I cannot help but feel sorry for him. As the gravediggers lower the coffin, I stifle a cry. I want to reach out and touch it one more time, as if doing so could turn back time to just a few days earlier, when everything was all right. Astrid steps forward and throws a handful of dirt into the hole in the ground. I follow her example, breathing in the deep, earthy smell, feeling the darkness below. Though I have never been to a funeral before, the ritual feels somehow familiar. I stare down into the dark hole. Thank you, I say silently to Herr Newhoff, for saving Theo and me. For all of it. In my whole life, there has never been anyone who has done more. I step back and brush the dirt off my hands, then lace my fingers with Astrid's. Swallowing back the lump that has formed in my throat, I study Astrid's face out of the corner of my eye. Her skin is pale, and her eyes hollow. But she has not cried. How is that possible? A few days ago, she was beginning her life with Peter. Now all of it is gone. She shudders, and I put my arm around her, our grief pressing silently together. My eyes burn, and I blink back the tears. Astrid has done so much to care for and protect me. It is my turn to be strong for her now. I wrap my arm more tightly around her shoulders. Then the funeral is over, and we start the long, slow walk back to the fairgrounds. In the distance, bells peal 11. I take a last look over my shoulder at the gravesite. As we skirt the edge of town, I can see wagons and lorries climbing the steep road to the market square, children walking to school more quietly than they once had. Where is Luke? I wonder. Even now I can't help but think of him and his proposal that we run away together. For a minute, even as I said no, I could see a glimmer of hope, a life that we might have had together. Now that, like everything else, seems gone. I have not seen him since the night of Peter's arrest, and there was no note in the belly box when I checked the past two mornings. I half expected him to turn up at the funeral and pay respects, but he hadn't. Maybe he sensed that he would not be welcome, or that Estrid might blame him yet again for all that had happened. When we reach the fairgrounds, we do not return to the train, but mill around the backyard, like parentless children. "We should rehearse for the show," Goethe says. I had nearly forgotten. It is Tuesday, with a performance tonight. Tickets have been sold and crowds will come.
"But we have no ringmaster,"
one of the horseback riders points out. Heads nod. Performing without Herr Neuhoff is hard to imagine. Once Peter might have filled in, but he is gone too.
"I can do it," Emmett says.
All eyes travel warily in his direction. He does not have the personality to engage the crowd. I've never even seen him set foot in the ring. But there is no other choice.
"It's only for one day before we leave,"
he adds.
"We can figure out something else after that."
"One day?"
Helmet, the animal trainer, asks.
"What do you mean? We aren't supposed to move on to the next village until Friday."
I recall Estrid telling me we would stay in Tears for 3 weeks before moving on to the next town, and we are still days short of that.
"We pack after tonight's show," Emmett replies. "Tear everything down. And we aren't going to the next town."
My skin prickles.
"We're turning back to a site near Strasbourg, in Alsace-Lorraine."
He delivers the bad news like it is some sort of trump card. There is a collective gasp. Tonight. The word bounces around in my brain. Emmett had told us the circus would be sent back, but I never expected it to actually happen so soon. I turn back toward Estrid, seeking her help, but she stands numbly, as if she hasn't heard.
"Alsace?"
one of the acrobats murmurs.
"That might as well be Germany."
I remember what Estrid had told me about Herr Neuhoff fighting to find us a way to stay in France.
"Can we appeal?"
I dare to ask.
Emmett shakes his head. "My father tried to get the order changed before all of this happened. Our request was rejected."
With Peter's arrest and everything that happened, there would be no reprieve. And Emmett is not a fighter. He would always choose the course of least resistance. We can't count on him to ask again.
"So we will perform in Alsace."
I tense, flooded with fear. I can't go back so close to Germany with Theo. It would be far too dangerous. I look southeast toward the hills and imagine what it would be like to take Theo and run. But I couldn't possibly abandon Estrid, especially now.
"What about the cities in France we've booked?"
I ask. Heads turn in my direction.
"If we start canceling, we won't be invited back next year. Think of the money we will lose."
"Next year?"
Emmett sneers, gesturing behind him.
"The circus is dying, Noah. There is no money. We've lost our ringmaster, and the Germans have just taken one of our star performers."
A choking noise, not quite a sob, catches in Astrid's throat. Emmett continues.
"They've humored us to a point, but whether it is now or a few months from now, this is the end. How much longer did you think this could go on?"
"We have to keep going," Estrid says. It is the first time she has spoken since before the funeral, and her voice has none of its usual strength.
"To save you?" Emmett retorts.
"To save all of us," I interject. "Including you. Do you know what the Germans do to those who hide people?" I step back, fearful I've said more than I should. Emmett's eyes widen.
We will keep going where we've been ordered for the rest of the season.
He relents.
At least as long as we can manage financially. Papa did not leave much.
A murmur travels among the performers. We grieve Herr Neuhoff, of course, and we will do so for a long time. The hole created by his loss is vast. But there is a practical side of things, too. How would the circus go on without him? Could it?
Surely your father had an insurance policy,
Helmut asks. All eyes look expectantly at Emmett, who shifts uneasily.
I believe my father had to cash it out last winter. We needed the money for expenses.
He's telling the truth, Astrid says quietly. It is just as well, I think. The money would have gone to Emmett as his heir, and he would not have used it for the greater good of the circus.
There was a will, though, Astrid continues. Jealousy registers in Emmett's eyes. He had not known his father or his affairs as well as Astrid. It had a provision that the circus is not to be sold.
Behind me, someone exhales. No one would buy the circus in these times, but if possible, Emmett would have sold it for the profits and run.
That's ridiculous,
Emmett flares. He had assumed that whatever was left would be his, that he would have free rein to do what he wanted. He had not expected this.
And it stipulates that all of the performers are to be kept on, unless there is misconduct,
Astrid adds.
At least I have one less performer to pay,
Emmett says coldly, crossing his arms as he delivers this final blow. Astrid, seemingly defeated, does not reply. I motion to put my arm around her, but she shrugs me off and begins to walk away.
Don't,
she says as I start to follow. She raises an arm to ward me off.
I've arranged a late breakfast for everyone,
Emmett says, sounding eager to end the discussion. We make our way wordlessly toward the cook tent. Fresh smells of sausage and rich brewing coffee tickle my nose. Inside, the few kitchen workers who had remained behind during the funeral have laid out a breakfast bigger than I have seen since we traveled to France. Eggs, and even a bit of real butter. A meal designed to comfort. I inventory the menu silently, cataloging as I always do, the bits I might be able to take back for Theo.
So much food,
I remark to one of the servers, who is refilling the plate of fried potatoes.
It seems foolish to waste it all now, no?
We won't have time to pack ice if we are leaving in a few hours, the server says. We have to eat the perishables now so they don't spoil.
I take a piece of toast and some eggs for myself, then sit down at an empty table. Emmett comes over carrying a heaping plate of food, his appetite seemingly unaffected by grief. He sits down without asking. I have not been alone with him since he confronted me at the wedding, and I fight the urge to stand up and leave. Then I remember his sadness at the funeral.
Such a hard day,
I remark, trying to be kind.
Things are going to get even harder,
he replies tersely.
There will be changes when we reach Alsace. We'll have to let most of the workers go.
The laborers are part of the circus, and they come faithfully each year in exchange for steady work, a promise kept on both sides. How can he do this?
I thought your father's will said everyone was to stay on, I offer.
His will only spoke of the performers,
he snaps.
Surely your father intended...
My father isn't here anymore,
he says, cutting me off.
We can't afford to keep everyone on. We will find help locally as we go. Just a minute earlier, I'd felt sorry for Emmett. Now my goodwill hardens. The wheels in his mind are turning, ready to bleed the circus of its talent, penny by penny, in order to draw the most benefit for the least possible work. His father's body is not even cold, and already Emmett is destroying things. He may be genuinely grieving his father, but he is also using it as an excuse for being as awful as he really wants.
"We can make do with half as many if everyone pitches in," he adds.
The suggestion belies how little he knows about what we do. Even I understand the manpower and expertise that are needed. I look over my shoulder in the direction of the train. If only Estrid was here to reason with Emmett. Then I remember her worn face and weak voice. In her present condition, she would be in no shape to manage it. "When will you tell them?" I ask.
"Not until we reach Alsace. The workers can stay with us until then."
Emmett says this benevolently, as if bestowing a great gift. But it is not for the laborers' benefit. He wants them to tear everything down, and to go back accounted for. "What about their contracts?" I ask.
"Contracts?"
Emmett repeats mockingly.
"Only the performers have those."
I do not argue further. My eyes travel across the dining room toward the laborers' tables, where a thin, graying handyman is clearing his plate, shoulders hunched. I recall the story about the Jewish handyman that Estrid had told me, the man Herr Neuhoff had given refuge. With Herr Neuhoff dead, and Emmett dismissing the workers, the man would have no sanctuary. Neither would Estrid, or any of the rest of us. "Some of these people have no homes to go back to," I say, staying purposely vague.
"You mean like the old Jew?"
Emmett asks harshly. I am unable to hide the surprise on my face.
"I know about him,"
he adds. I instantly regret having spoken, but it is too late to turn back. "If you tell him before we go, he might have the chance to escape before we leave."
"Escape? He has no papers."
Emmett leans in close to me, his voice low, breath hot and sour.
"I'm not telling him or the other workers now. And you better not either, if you know what is good for you."
He does not bother to hide his threat. My blood chills. Emmett would not hesitate to throw a person to the wolves if it suited his purpose, including me. Not wanting to listen any longer, I stand and pocket the napkin I use to wrap some eggs and toast for Theo. "Excuse me," I say. I walk from the cook tent, back toward the train. As I cross the fairgrounds, I pass Drina, the fortune teller, seated beneath a different tree, closer now than the time I had seen her before. She smiles faintly and holds her tarot deck up to me, an offering. But I shake my head. I no longer want to see the future. That night, the crowds are still making their way from the fairgrounds, when the crews begin tearing down the circus. Unlike the raising of the big top, its demise is anticlimactic, a sight nobody wants to see. Poles clank as they fall upon one another, and the canvas begins to collapse like a parachute billowing to the earth. The enormous tent, once full of people and laughter, is gone, as though it was never there at all. I step over discarded programs and crushed popcorn kernels that have been matted into the ground. What will be here once we are gone? I scan the desolate scene, looking once more for Estrid. She had not come to the show. Earlier, as I prepared to perform, I kept searching the backyard, hoping. But she had not emerged from the train all night. It was the first time I had performed without her nearby, and I felt helpless, as though the safety net had somehow been removed. With Herr Neuhoff gone, I needed her more than ever. Goethe walks over to me.
"Come," she says. "We should get changed and prepare to go."
It is the most she had said to me since I joined the circus, and I wonder if she senses how lost I am without Astrid. "When do we go?" I ask, as we start back to the train to change.
"Not for a few hours," Goethe replies.
"They'll finish tearing down sometime after we are asleep, but Emmett has ordered everyone to remain on board." A few more hours until we leave Tears for good. Luke appears in my mind. I had not had the chance to tell him we were going or say goodbye. I gaze longingly over my shoulder in the direction of town, wondering if there is time to find Luke. I think about how I might sneak out unnoticed, but I wouldn't dare go to Luke's father's house after all that had happened, and I do not know where else I might find him. In the dressing car, the girls are quiet as they remove their costumes and makeup, and there is none of the excitement of when we'd left Darmstadt. When I have finished changing, I start back to the sleeper. I expect to find Astrid, as I so often do, holding Theo, but he is with Elsie. I take Theo from her.
"Where's Astrid?"
"She hasn't come back," Elsie replies.
"Back?"
I repeat. I had assumed that since she had not been at the show, she had stayed here in bed, as she had much of the time since Peter was arrested.
"She hasn't been here since before the show," Elsie says.
"I thought she was with you." I peer out the window of the sleeper. Where has Astrid gone? I hadn't seen her in the big top during the show, nor anywhere on the fairgrounds as the teardown had begun after. I carry Theo from the train and scan the length of the cars toward the front of the train, but I do not see Astrid. She wouldn't have gone far just as we are about to leave, unless she had gone in a last desperate attempt to find Peter. I look in the direction of town, my concern growing. "Easy," I think. Even Astrid in her current state would have known that was impossible. My eyes travel the length of the train in the opposite direction, toward the rear, taking in the final carriage that had been Herr Neuhoff's. Then, taking in the one in front of it, I understand. Astrid did not leave. Instead, she has gone to the place where she felt closest to Peter. I start in the direction of his rail car. I find her lying in Peter's unmade bed, curled into a ball, facing away from me. She clutches the sheet in both hands. "Astrid?" I sit down beside her, relieved. "When I couldn't find you, I thought..." I do not finish the thought. Instead, I put my hand on her shoulder and gently roll her over, expecting to see tears at last. But her face is stony, eyes blank. Though the rail car is chilly, faint perspiration coats her upper lip. My concern rises again. "Astrid, are you feeling worse? Has your bleeding started again?"
"No, of course not."
I reach out and touch her head. "You still feel warm." I should have fought her harder when she refused to see a doctor, but now there is no time. I hand Theo to Astrid, then lie down beside them, smelling Peter in the soiled sheets and trying not to think of the nights he and Astrid have spent here while on the road. I want to tell her what Emmett said about the workers, but I cannot burden her now. A moment later, her breathing evens, and when I look over, she is asleep. Theo squirms restlessly beside her, not ready to settle down in the unfamiliar space. There is a loud bang, and the whole carriage rocks with the force of something heavy being loaded into an adjacent rail car. "It will be all right," I say, more for myself than him. I press my palm gently against his back, moving it in small, soothing circles. His eyelids begin to flutter, staying closed longer for a second each time as they do when he is falling asleep. When Theo has quieted, I roll over, thinking of Luke. He would find out I had left, of course, but not until it was too late. Would he learn, too, where I had gone? Once he had promised to find me, but I can't see how that's possible. We will be hundreds of miles away. I sit up and peer out the window at the familiar sight of the fairgrounds, the forest leading to town behind it. We are still here. I can get off the train and go to Luke to let him know we are going, and still make it back in time without anyone noticing. Or maybe even take Theo and leave with Luke for good, I think, remembering his proposal. But where would we go? We have no papers to cross the border, no money for food and shelter. Then I look over at Estrid. Even if it were possible, I would not dare. I close my eyes. Sometime later, there is a great heave, and the train struggles forward. I sit up once more and look southeast out the window, imagining the freedom that lies just a few hundred kilometers away in Switzerland. Beside me, Estrid's body rises and falls methodically with deep sleep. My fate is tied up with hers now, whatever happens. The train presses forward, and the town of Tyr seems to shrink, growing lower and flatter into the earth as we pick up speed. And then it is gone. I touch the glass where the village had been seconds earlier, leaving Luke and our chance at freedom behind.
Chapter 21. Estrid. The squeak of a doorknob turning, hands pressing against hard wood. Through sleep, I think I am back in the winter quarters, Peter coming to tell me that he has found someone in the woods near Darmstadt. But when I open my eyes, I see that it is only Noah, hurrying into the tiny cabin we have shared in the past 5 days since reaching Alsace. I close my eyes once more, willing the vision of earlier times to return. Estrid! Noah's voice, tight with urgency, yanks me from my memories. I roll over. She is peering out the filthy window, her body stiff and face pale.
You have to get up!
Have they come again? I ask, struggling to sit. Before she can answer, there is a loud clattering outside. A police inspection. Officers rattling through the wagons and the tents. Once I might have run and hid. But there is no hiding place here. Let them take me, I think. There is a hard knock on the door that startles both of us. I sit up, reach for my robe. Theo lets out a wail. Noah opens the door to reveal 2 SS officers. Always 2, I muse. Except, of course, the night they had taken Peter.
Wer ist da?
One of the men, taller and thin, barks. Who is there?
I'm Noah Weil, she offers, managing to keep the quaver from her voice.
The officer gestures toward me.
And her?
A moment's hesitation.
I'm Astrid Sorrel,
I say, when Noah does not.
The same as when you asked 2 days ago,
I cannot help but add.
What do they think will be so different each time? What did you say?
He demands. Noah shoots me a withering look. Nothing, I mutter. No good can come from antagonizing them. The other officer takes a step into the cabin.
Is she ill?
He nods his head in my direction.
Yes, I want to say. The Nazis are known to fear illness.
Perhaps if they think I am contagious, they will leave us alone.
No,
Noah replies firmly, before I can answer.
Her eyes dart nervously in my direction.
"And the child?" he asks.
"My little brother," Noah says with conviction, the lie now long familiar.
"His papers are here as well."
"Are you thirsty, sirs?"
Noah offers, changing the subject before he can ask further questions. She reaches behind her bed and produces half a bottle of cognac I had not known she had. The man's eyes widen, then narrow again. It is a calculated risk. Will he take the bribe or accuse her of stealing or hoarding the liquor? He takes the bottle and starts toward the door, the shorter man in tow. When they have gone, Noah closes the door. She picks up Theo and sinks to the bed beside me.
"I didn't think they would come again so soon after the last time," she says, shaken. "Almost every day, like clockwork," I reply, turning away from her.
Looking out the window of the cabin where we have billeted since our arrival. In Alsace, the most worn of regions, all pretense of normalcy is gone. Across a thin strip of river lies the town of Colmar, its once elegant skyline of Renaissance churches and timber houses crumbled after the air raids. Trees that would have been blooming other years in early May snapped in half like twigs. German trucks and Kubelwagen line the roads.
"The cognac," I say. "Where did you get it?"
A guilty expression crosses Noah's face.
"From Herr Neuhoff's rail car. Emmett was going through things the other day, taking what he wanted. I didn't think he would notice."
"That was smart thinking." Thank God she did not offer them food. Rations have shrunk to a fraction of what they were in Thiers. We barely have enough to feed ourselves and Theo.
"But it's gone now," Noah frets. "They'll expect more next time."
"We'll think of something," I say. I lie down once more, my throat scratchy from the halo of burnt smoke and coal dust that seems to hang constantly in the air. The cabin, just big enough for Noah, Theo, and myself, is scarcely a step above camping, with a roof that leaks and a floor that is mostly dirt. We cannot sleep on the train as we had in Thiers, for fear the British RAF pilots might bomb the rail lines. So we have moved to the low cabins, not much more than huts without indoor plumbing, once used as work sheds by workers at the adjacent quarry. Not that they are so much safer. The fairgrounds here are close to the roadway, and military vehicles rumble down it all night, making it a prime target for the air raids as well. Last night, the bombs fell so close, I pulled Noah and Theo under my cot, and we huddled against the cold earth until dawn. It has been nearly a week since Peter was arrested, taken God only knows where. I see it now in my waking thoughts, like a bad dream I cannot erase. Herr Neuhoff is gone too. Left behind in a hillside grave in Auvergne. I wrap my arms around my stomach, feeling the hollowness and mourning all that will never be. After Eric and my family, I thought I had already lost everything, that nothing more could be taken from me. But this, the final blow, is too much. I had let myself hope again, against every promise I had made myself when I left Berlin. I let myself get close, and now I am paying the price. Noah presses her hand to my forehead.
"No fever," she says,
the relief evident in her voice. Bless her. She tries so very hard to care for me. Her concern is a drop of water, though, unable to fill the ocean of void in my heart. Noah reaches down and takes both of my hands in hers.
"Astrid, I have good news."
For a second, my heart lifts. Perhaps she has word of Peter. Then I catch myself. Can she bring back the dead? Turn back time? I pull away. There is no good news anymore.
Emmett said, "You can perform again," she says, then pauses, watching my face for a reaction. Does she expect me to leap up with joy and change into my practice leotard? Once, returning to the trapeze was all I wanted, but it does not matter anymore.
"Let's go practice," Noah urges, still trying for all her best to make things better.
It doesn't help at all, but I love her for caring.
"Astrid, I know how hard this is, but lying here isn't going to change things. Why not fly again?"
"Because doing the normal things feels like accepting that Peter is gone," I think. "A betrayal."
"What's the point?" I ask finally.
Noah hesitates.
"Astrid, you must get up again."
"Why?" She looks away, as if not wanting to tell me.
"Remember Yetta?"
"Of course." Yetta had survived her fall and been sent to a hospital near Vichy to convalesce. I am suddenly uneasy.
"What about her?"
"I asked Emmett about her before we left Thiers, and he said she was being sent back to Darmstadt to finish healing. But then I heard the workers whispering
that she had been taken from the hospital and sent east on one of the trains."
Noah's voice drops to a whisper.
"Arrested?"
I ask. "Like Peter." Noah nods.
"No one is arrested for a broken leg, Noah. That's ridiculous. She didn't do anything wrong."
But even as I say this, I doubt my own words. These days, a person could be arrested for just about anything, or nothing at all.
"They said if she couldn't perform, then her working papers were no longer valid,"
Noah continues.
"You have to get better, Astrid, for all of our sakes."
I realize that this was why Noah was so quick to tell the Germans I was not sick. They can smell weakness, and want nothing more than to exploit it.
"Please, come with me to the ring. If you don't feel well enough to practice, at least watch and tell me what to fix."
Noah's voice is pleading.
"Performing with a gun to the head," I say. "Where is the joy in that?"
It is not about joy now, though, but survival. And Noah is right. Lying here will not change things or bring Peter back. The circus, my act, they are the only things I have.
"Fine,"
I say, standing up. She takes Theo to the cabin where Elsie is staying as I find my practice leotard and hold it up to the light, remembering the last time I had worn it, feeling Peter's touch against the fabric. My throat grows scratchy. Perhaps I cannot do this after all. But I put on the leotard. When Noah returns, I let her lead me from the cabin. We cross the fairgrounds. The workers have done their best to assemble everything, from the beer tent to the carousel, exactly as they had been in Thiers. But the grounds here are abysmal. A dirt field at the edge of an abandoned stone quarry, uneven and pockmarked from fighting that had passed this way earlier in the war. As we near the big top, I glimpse the trapeze through the open flap. Then I stop. How can I ever fly again, knowing that Peter will not be there to see me? Noah takes my hand.
"Astrid, please."
"I can do it," I say, shaking her off. Inside, I can see that nothing is right. The tent has been shoddily erected with the grounds not properly prepared, and with less than half the workers, most local and inexperienced. What would Herr Neuhoff have thought of his grand circus, now in tatters? The will had stipulated that the circus go on, but there are 1,000 little details it could not account for. about wages and living conditions and working hours and such. It would be easy to blame Emmett. The downfall of the circus had not begun with him, though. The cracks had been months or years in coming. Only now, in this godforsaken village with no one to lead us, the weaknesses have been exposed, their full depth revealed. Enough. I steel myself. With the circus in such a state, Noah and the others need me more than ever. I start forward with new determination, pull back the flap of the big top, then lift my head to appraise the state of the trapeze apparatus. Above, a dark, unfamiliar object catches my eye. For a second, I think it is one of the other aerialists rehearsing. I step back, not ready to face anyone else yet. The person in the air does not move with any force, though, but rather hangs limply. What on earth? I move closely for a better look. From the Spanish web, where I had once performed, hangs the lifeless body of Metz, the clockmaker.
Astrid, what is it?
Noah asks as I sink to the ground. It is almost impossible to hear her over the buzzing in my ears growing louder.
Are you feeling okay?
She asks. Her gaze is focused downward on me, not seeing the horror of what I see above.
This was a mistake. Let me help you get back to bed.
Call for the workers,
I command. But even as I say this, I know it is too late.
Go now!
I want her to leave the tent to spare her from the sight. But her eyes follow my gaze upward, and she lets out a blood-curdling scream. I grab Noah by the shoulders and force her from the big top.
The laborers, I order again, more firmly now. Go!
Alone now, I stare up at Metz. I had seen Herr Neuhoff die just days earlier, but this is different. Metz died because he was a Jew, and because he thought all hope was gone. That could have been me. I stand silently, touching my coat where the star should have been, a moment of solidarity.
In the big top,
I hear Noah calling outside.
Please hurry!
Two workers rush into the tent. I stand alone, watching as the laborers climb the ladder, then try to reach out with the long pole we used to pull in the trapeze bar in order to retrieve Metz. I turn away, sickened, and not wanting to see any more. Noah hurries back in, Emmett close behind.
Damn it,
he swears.
Should we call the police?
Noah asks.
No, of course not. Emmett snaps. We can't afford to attract attention from the police.
But if someone killed him, we have to report it.
She protests with more force than I imagined she might show against Emmett. He does not answer, but storms from the tent. I put my hand on her shoulder.
No, no one killed him. He killed himself.
What? I watch her expression as she grapples with the idea.
Surely you've heard of suicide.
Yes, of course. But how can you be sure?
There are no signs of a struggle, I explain. I just wish I knew why.
Noah's face crumbles.
He must have found out.
Found out what?
I demand. She hesitates, and I can tell she has been keeping something from me.
Emmett said he was letting the workers go.
What?
I am stunned by the notion. Metz must have somehow learned of Emmett's plan. With his family gone and no chance of sanctuary, he had given up, taken his life instead of letting it be taken. He had not seen another way out.
I'm sorry I didn't tell you sooner,
Noah says quickly.
Emmett threatened me if I said anything, and I didn't want to worry you.
Not listening to the rest of her explanation, I walk from the tent. Word has spread quickly through the fairgrounds, and workers and performers have clustered outside the big top.
I circle the gathering and find Emmett on the far side, standing uneasy and separate from the others.
How could you? I demand. We need these people.
His eyes widen.
You've been lying around for days, and now you want to tell me how to run the show?
He snarls.
You've got some nerve. It's you who's got the nerve, Emmett.
Noah's voice comes from behind me.
If you had told them before we left Tears, that man might have had a chance. This is none of your concern, he counters. Are you going to tell them, or am I?
He is caught off guard by Noah's defiance. The others draw closer now, having overheard.
Tell us what?
One of the acrobats demands. Emmett shifts uncomfortably, then turns to the crowd that has assembled.
I'm sorry to tell you that the circus is nearly out of money. We will be letting all of the workers go. Except for the foreman, I interject quickly.
I am overstepping my place, but I do not care. I continue quickly before Emmett can protest.
And those who have been with the circus for more than 5 years.
If everyone left at once, there would be no one to run the show.
God damn it,
one of the workers swears.
You can't do this. There's no other choice,
Emmett replies coldly.
You will each receive 2 weeks' pay and the train ticket home,
I add.
Isn't that right, Emmett?
Emmett glares at me. Clearly he had not been planning that.
Yes, yes, of course, if you go peacefully. Now, if you will excuse me, I have business to attend to.
He slinks away, keeping his eyes on us, as if afraid to turn his back. When he has gone, the workers begin to dissipate, still grumbling. The performers, spared for now, go more quietly to rehearse. At last, only Noah and I remain outside the big top. Behind us, there is a clattering noise, and I turn in time to see the two workers who had gotten Metz down carry his body from the big top.
Oh, Noah says, covering her mouth with her hand.
Astrid, I still don't understand it. Even if things were so bad, he would just give up like that.
Don't judge,
I say, the rebuke in my voice sharper than I intended.
Sometimes surrounding just gets to be too much.
Chapter 22 Noah. The next day, Emmett blocks my way as I start from the cook tent back to our cabin after breakfast.
Where's Astrid? He demands, arms crossed. She isn't back to practicing?
He presses. Not yet, I say. I shift the bowl of porridge I've taken for Astrid out of his view.
Now that we are out of Tears, there's no reason for her not to rejoin the show. So why hasn't she?
She doesn't feel well, I say, lying for Astrid instinctively, even though it could cost me my job if Emmett found out. In some sense, it is true. And we tried yesterday. You saw that. But then there was that business with the worker. He waves his hand, as though the clockmaker was of no consequence.
She needs to be back in the show by tomorrow, Emmett says. Everyone has to pull his weight around here. No more lollygagging for that one, he adds.
The notion of Astrid being lazy is so ridiculous I almost laugh aloud. I want to argue again that it is too soon for her to swing again, after all that she has been through, that she needs a few more days to get back on her feet. But I know he will not be swayed. Taking my silence as agreement, he continues on. I begin to walk again, pulling my coat over my head to avoid the thick spring drizzle that has begun to fall. I peer across the roadway, where a thin strip of river separates us from the town of Colmar. I had crossed the bridge into town once since our arrival, to see if there was anything to be had at market beyond our tiny rations. But my trip had been useless, The lone seller at what had once been a bustling town market had only some unidentifiable meat, which would have been too tough for Theo, even without the foul smell. Indeed, the whole town seemed to be stripped bare by the years of war. The streets were nearly deserted at midday, except for a stray dog by the gutter, and the SS, who seemed to watch from every corner. The shutters on the houses and shops were drawn. The faces of the few townsfolk I saw, all women, since the local men had been drafted against their will and sent in droves to fight in the east, were pinched by hunger and fear. We might as well have been back in Germany. I hurried from the town center, past the barbed wire and ditches that had been erected as a kind of haphazard fortification around the perimeter, and returned to the fairgrounds. I had not gone into town again since. I head toward the cabin, recalling Emmett's angry red face as he insisted Astrid perform. Since we arrived in Alsace nearly a week ago, she has lain in bed, curled up like a wounded animal. Other than her one attempt to return to the big top, that ended when we found the clockmaker, she hasn't left the cabin. I've stayed close, doing what I can for her. It is not enough, though. Every last bit of her will seems gone. Save her, Peter's eyes had seemed to say, in those final minutes before he was taken. But how? Even if I feed her, make her drink, her spirit is gone. I can barely care for Theo and myself. Under the weight of all three of us, I will break. What will Emmett do if Astrid refuses to return to the show? I shiver at the thought. I need to get her up and moving. As I pass the train parked and empty at the end of the line, my eyes travel wistfully to the underside of our sleeper car and the belly box where Luke and I had once left word for one another. I wonder if Luke might have followed the circus after we had left Tears, but know that it is impossible. I walk to the box and pull it open, almost hoping that something might be there. Of course it is empty. I run my hand over the rough wood, imagining Luke doing the same. Inside the cabin, I am surprised to find Astrid sitting up on the bed in her dressing gown. "Peter," Astrid says as I near. I freeze. Has she gone mad from all of her grief? "No, it's me, Noah," I say, stepping closer. She is not having delusions of Peter, but rather staring at a crumpled photograph. I approach Astrid carefully and get a better look at the picture. It is one I have never seen before of the two of them sitting in the backyard, under a parasol on a sunny day in street clothes, not costume. "Where was that taken?" As she passes it to me, I notice that her once perfect manicure is gone, the nails shredded where she has chewed on them. "A little town just outside Salzburg. It was in summer. The first season after I returned. Before I had arrived, I think. It feels strange to imagine the circus when I was not here. We weren't together yet, you know. Just getting to know each other." She smiles, her eyes far away. "We would talk and play cards for hours. He was fierce at card games. Gin, rummy, poker. We would start with a drink in the afternoon, and the next thing I knew, the whole night had passed." I study the photograph. Even then, Peter's eyes were somber, as though he knew what was to come. "It would have been his birthday tomorrow," she adds, and her expression saddens once more. She speaks as though he is already dead. I fight the urge to correct her, not wanting to offer false hope. From the other cot, Theo stirs. I pick him up, kissing the top of his head. Our one blessing. Through all of the hardship, Theo has thrived. His cheeks are still round, and his hair has grown thick and curly,
a dark meringue. Still holding Theo, I sit down beside Astrid gently. Everything has been taken from her. A chance at a child,